Maybe you've noticed that the world that we live in today is not the same as the one that our parents or our grandparents grew up in. That might be a huge understatement. Things have not only changed dramatically from the past, things are changing more quickly than ever. And things continue to change. And things are changing that people believed would never, ever change. Technology has changed so much of the world. I mean, we carry computers around in our pocket that are more powerful than the computers that landed man on the moon. That's how much things have changed. If you talk to people over a certain age, and I won't mention an age because that will just leave some people out and it wouldn't be accurate for everyone, but you know who you are. Some people feel that the changes that are taking place are just far too much and far too fast. Many people have this feeling like they're standing on a train platform waiting for the train to come in so they can get on. What they're hoping for and what they've come to expect or what they've been used to is this. This is the kind of experience we're expecting when we talk about change. This slow train pulls gently into the station. And it stops right in front of us. And then we're able to get on the train. And then the train continues on to the next station. That train comes in nice and slowly. And then waits for us to get on. That's the way change used to happen. That's the way things used to go. That's the way generations past would experience change. But that isn't how change happens any longer. Instead of a train coming slowly and predictably into the station and stopping so you can get on, now change happens like this. That's what change looks like today. And if you notice, the train didn't even stop. That's the way change happens. Change comes roaring through the station at hundreds of miles an hour, not even slowing down, but they expect you to get on the train. You're not even sure what the change is because the train passed by you so fast. Now, frankly, some people don't care that they're missing out on change. They think that whatever they are missing isn't important anyways. It's only technology. It's only the newest fad or the newest movement. They're satisfied with where they're at and what they know. They don't want or need anything more. Now, some people are anxious to get on and stay on the train. They want to experience all the changes. They want to keep up with the changes. And this idea is more than just a feeling. It's more than just an emotion. This is really happening to our world in real time. In 1982, in a book entitled Critical Path, an architect and scientist named Brookminster Fuller created the knowledge doubling curve. And he noticed that until 1900, human knowledge doubled approximately every 100 years. By the end of World War II, knowledge was doubling every 25 years. And as time moves on, the pace of change has begun to speed up, so much so that today things are not at all quite so simple. And different types of knowledge have different rates of growth. For example, nanotechnology, the technology of little tiny things, little tiny computers, that knowledge is doubling every 2 years, and clinical knowledge is doubling every 18 months. But on average, human knowledge is doubling every 13 months. Let you absorb that for a minute. Every 13 months now, knowledge is doubling. And IBM, the builder of the Internet of Things, says eventually the doubling of knowledge will take place every 12 hours. A recent Apple commercial highlights the speed and how fast these changes are taking place. Did you catch the last line of that commercial? What's a computer? That's how fast things are changing. If you haven't caught up to the last 10 changes that have taken place, how are you going to keep up with the next 100 that are coming next? So what, Pastor? Why should any of us care that technology is changing so fast that we can't keep up? Well, the reason we need to care is the changes are not limited to technology. These changes are impacting every area of our culture. They impact how we live and relate to other people. They impact how we see the events that are taking place, our perspective on how we view other people, other cultures, and other belief systems are all changing right along with technology. Not even our faith journey is able to avoid the rapid changes that are taking place in the culture. For example, in years gone by, if you wanted to listen to a different preacher or check out a different church, or you wanted to experience a different denomination or religion, you would have to physically get up and go to a different place. Today, from the phone that is in your pocket or is in your purse, you can listen to and hear teaching from every worldview and every religious persuasion and any idea you could possibly imagine. Those are all available to you right where you're sitting right now. When this church was planted 80 or so years ago, you had very few choices of what people believed about things like God or salvation, about science, about evolution, about sexual morality, about hell and the trustworthiness of the Bible. There weren't many choices of worldviews. There was orthodox or accepted Christian beliefs, and there were people who disagreed with those things, but they were generally only scholarly types. For the most part, the Christian biblical worldview was fairly well accepted by a large portion of our population. What Christians believed was challenged, but not openly and not very often. Not like today. Just follow any Facebook post that mentions a biblical stand on an issue like abortion, about sexual morality, or whether it's right to say Jesus is the only way or not. Follow the thread. And you will see challenge after challenge after challenge to what Christian orthodoxy teaches. One of the foundational changes that has taken place over the last few decades is how the culture views truth. What constitutes truth? How the culture sees, accepts, and receives what is truth has changed dramatically. The truth of my parents and grandparents is no longer the truth of today. The way the culture perceives what is true has changed and is continuing to change. My parents, when they were first saved through Alcoholics Anonymous, they were told that the Bible is true, you can trust it, and you can live by it. And they said, okay, we trust that it's true. We trust that we can live by it. It's absolute truth. There's no reason for us to doubt that the Bible is true. Two generations later, truth is now seen. What is true for one person may not be true for another. There is what's true for today, but that might change depending on circumstances as to what's true tomorrow. Depending on what's popular or what's expedient might change what's true. And absolute truth is viewed not only doubtful, but is suspicious and is downright dangerous in the eyes of the culture. That's a drastic change. But God warns us that that would happen. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 3 to 5, it says, "For a time is coming when people will no longer listen to sound and wholesome teaching. They will follow their own desires and will look for teachers who will tell them whatever their itching ears want to hear. They will reject the truth and chase after myths. But you should keep a clear mind in every situation. Don't be afraid of suffering for the Lord. Work at telling others the good news and fully carry out the ministry God has given you." So while the culture has changed, it is changing quickly and has changed dramatically, especially in how it perceives truth, how it receives truth, and interacts with what is truth, the church, Christ followers, have not kept up with the changes. Now, before anybody gets a knot in their stomach and thinking that the pastor is going to go off on some tangent here, we're going to talk about changing truth, let me put your mind at ease. The gospel message, the hope we have in Jesus, will never change or will never need to be changed. It's the same today as it was 2,000 years ago when he said in John 14:6, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me." You will never hear anything else come from this preacher in regards to the gospel. It is a solid rock. We can count on it. But what should be open to change? And what needs to change is the method we use to bring the gospel to people. We should always be open and ready to explore the best way to communicate that to people. The when, the where, the how, those are the things that we should be ready to change. The what should never change. But this message of series of messages isn't about whether or not we should serve coffee that people can bring into the auditorium. This isn't about whether, you know, the pastor wears jeans and a t-shirt or a suit and a tie. That train, pardon the pun, has long left the station. The culture doesn't care about that nearly as much as we think they do. When it comes to matters of faith, about salvation, whether people believe or don't believe in God, or how people perceive the truth of Scripture, the problem is not whether or not you have comfy chairs or pews. That doesn't matter. But there are real roadblocks. Do not think for a minute that there aren't things standing in the way of people coming to know who Jesus is. Unfortunately, some Christ followers are not dealing with any of the actual problems people are having these days. People have questions, legitimate questions about what Christians believe, but we aren't answering them. Sometimes people are afraid to ask a Christian a question because we don't deal well with questions. We immediately go into attack mode when someone asks us to explain what we believe. We assume every question is an attack on us, so we create hostility where none actually exists. But when people are brave enough to ask us something, when they ask for answers, our answers aren't very good sometimes. We over-spiritualize things or we use words that people don't understand. Sometimes our answers are shallow and they can't bear the weight of any more questions. Sometimes our answers are just wrong. Sometimes they're hurtful. Sometimes they're damaging to the gospel because they don't line up with God's word or his heart of love for humanity. Something we should always be trying to do as a church, and something we should always be trying to do as believers, is answer questions that people are actually asking. This series is entitled, What's Your Problem? We're going to address 10 different areas that the culture takes issue with Christians on. 10 questions that people are asking for answers to, that if we can do a fair job, it doesn't have to be an excellent job, doesn't have to be perfect. If we do a fair job of answering these questions, it can hopefully make a way for more people to come to an understanding of who Jesus is and hear the gospel that will never change. Some of the things that we're going to cover in this series are the problem of hypocrisy, the problem of evil and suffering. Get ready for this one. The problem of sex, the problem of the Bible, the problem of hell, and the problem of Jesus. Those are just a few of the things that we're going to talk about over the next few months. Now, I have two reasons for working through this series, and I was so encouraged at our weekend away when the leadership went away on the retreat. One of the leaders got up and said, look, you know what we need? We need to give people, disciples, some practical tools to deal with the questions that come up. We don't have answers to some of the things that we have people ask us. And I was like, yes, that's right in the wheelhouse. That's exactly what we're going to be talking about. So here's one of the reasons why we're doing this series. Because it's part of my job description. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 to 12. Now these are the gifts Christ gave to the church. The apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, and the pastors and teachers. Their responsibility is to equip God's people to do his work and build up the church, the body of Christ. Churches are to be equipping stations for believers. That's what we are. We're to equip believers to do the work of the ministry. And this is equipping for believers. So you have answers to questions. And the second reason we're doing this is that these problems are unnecessary roadblocks that keep people from surrendering their lives to Jesus. Look, we're talking about people who are seeking answers. They're seeking after God. It's ingrained in them. God's built that into them to seek after him. But there's roadblocks that get in the way. We're going to try and remove some of those roadblocks. This series is meant to help equip Christ followers to answer questions people are actually asking and also directly speak to those who are skeptics and have honest questions about their Christian faith. If you want some solid answers for your friends and your family who are honestly seeking to know the truth, I encourage you to lean in, to take some notes, to follow along. And even more important, invite them to church. If there was ever a series of messages that is going to speak to those who are seeking, to speak to those who have questions or concerns about Christianity, this is the one. Invite your unchurched friends, your questioning skeptic coworker, or your doubting Thomas neighbor to this series. This week we're going to deal with our first problem. It's the problem of science. In the minds of many people, there is a battle going on between science and faith. You might even have a picture in your mind of the characters that represent both of these sides. One side's represented by this guy, our friend Ned Flanders. And then the other side of the argument is this guy, Mr. E equals MC squared. The general argument of science versus faith goes something like this. Christianity and faith are generally seen as being simplistic, illogical, and lacking reason. Science is portrayed as being based on truth, facts, and evidence. Faith is portrayed as being based on hope and legends, while science is seen as the quest for unbiased evidence. Faith counts on old dusty books, and science is rooted in new technology and discovery. Where did those ideas come from? Where did that sentiment begin? How did that get rooted in our culture? How did faith and science end up in this battle? That's a good question. If you look back into history, in the 16 to the 1800s, the period of history called the Enlightenment, during that period, a philosophy was born called secularism. Secularism is defined as a system of political or social philosophy that rejects all forms of religious faith and worship. Secularism, this idea, promotes itself as there's no spiritual reality, nothing beyond what we can see or prove. That God cannot possibly be real because he cannot be seen. But secularism goes beyond just the idea that there is no God. It also pushes an agenda that states anyone who believes otherwise should be disregarded as being ignorant. Ignorant of truth and delusional. Richard Dawkins, a popular atheist and thinker of the current day, says, "Faith is like a mental illness." Another philosopher, Sam Harris, said, "We have names for people who have many beliefs for which there is no rational justification. When their beliefs are extremely common, we call them religious. Otherwise, they are likely to be called mad, delusional, or psychotic." The case people like this are making is that science is based on current evidence and rational justification, while Christianity is based on avoiding evidence and holding on to old, outdated thinking. Now, those ideas have been shared so many times and so long and so often that they have become to believe as truth. Many people take this idea that science and faith are at odds as truth. The question that needs to be asked when we make a truth assumption, when we say, yeah, that's true, is it actually true? This is a question skeptics need to ask about what they believe about the problem of science. Is what I have come to believe about science in regards to faith actually correct? What if what has come to be taken as true, this idea that faith and science are directly opposed to each other, isn't true? What if faith and science occupy the same space? And instead of being apart from each other, are actually moving together in a beautifully choreographed production? The idea that science and faith are at war doesn't have a basis in historical fact. It just isn't true. And I'm going to show you why. Take the story of the astronomer Galileo. The story of Galileo is often used by atheists and secularists to build a foundation as to how the church and science became at war. The story goes that Galileo was unfairly tortured and imprisoned because he refuted the church's belief that the earth and not the sun was the center of our universe. That's the story that's shared. What's actually true is that there was a disagreement between Galileo and the church at one time, but for the most of Galileo's life, he was a good Catholic and a friend of the church. This animosity that's talked about did not materialize at all, since that the story goes. It just did not happen. Another issue that needs to be corrected in the science versus the church myth is the idea that Christianity was at the heart of the flat earth idea, which is an idea that happens to be coming back even now. And here's a great cartoon about the flat earth. All educated historians agree about this point. The idea that the medieval church believed the earth was flat and that science came along and proved that wrong never happened. From the time of the ancient Greeks, the world knew that the earth was round. It was obvious, even in the Middle Ages and before, that this, because when a ship sailed over the horizon, its hull disappeared before its mast did. So we knew that the earth was round. This idea that Christianity is at odds with science over the fact of the earth being round is just not true. Christianity is not at odds with science. In fact, of all the theistic worldviews, of all the world religions, it's the one that gives science permission to explore the world we live in. If you believe in animism, which means that every tree and every animal or every object is a god or has God in it, you are not encouraged to investigate those things because they are deities. You can't investigate God. You cannot subject a god to objective analysis. So animism doesn't support science. If you are a Buddhist, the universe and everything in it is an illusion. It's pointless to investigate the universe because whatever you discover will also be an illusion. If you were a Hindu, there is no need to ask why the sky is blue or volcanoes erupt because the only answer is that the gods caused it to happen. There's no point investigating those things. Christianity provides the philosophical foundation that is needed for scientific discovery to be possible. A guy named Kenneth Samples gives 10 reasons why a Christian worldview is necessary for science to thrive. I want to share a few of them with you. First, Christianity asserts that the universe is a distinct, knowable reality that can be discovered. Christianity says, yes, we can know the universe. It says the laws of nature speak of an order, speaks of patterns and regularity. Christianity says the world is valuable and worth studying. It says the world is not divine and not worthy of our worship, so it can be and should be studied. Christianity also says God encouraged scientific study when he gave man dominion over the earth. Mark Clark, author of the book, The Problem of God, which was the source for much of what you're going to be hearing throughout this series, says this: Christian theology was the garden out of which modern science grew because it presented a world with distinct form, complexity, and design. The idea that science and Christianity are in direct conflict cannot stand up to real scientific discovery. If you are a scientist, if you have the mind of a scientist, put that idea that science and religion are at war, put it to the scientific test. It will not be able to stand up to the scientific method. Another misconception that needs to be cleared up is the idea that having faith means you can't be scientific. There's this assumption that to be a Christian or religious means you live by blind belief, like we saw in the opening video, the guy that lived by blind faith and said, oh, my kids told me there's a gorilla that messed up their room, and he believed them. That's the idea that if you're scientific, you cannot be filled with faith because they are in opposition to each other. This assumption is also incorrect. No one can say they do not live by faith. Everyone makes choices and decisions based on what they believe to be true all the time. Now, we each have a unique worldview that shapes how we see things. We're shaped by our experiences, our family history, our environment, the media, education. These variables lead us to believe or assume things that have not yet been proven. Take, for instance, the discussion of the end of life. You would know people, even people who aren't people of faith, that would say things like what I'm going to share with you. When a person dies and their life ends, people will say things like, well, at least their suffering is over. How many have heard people say that before? How many have said that before, right? Even people who are not necessarily Christians say and believe that thing. Well, how do we know that? How do we know that death means the end of suffering? What empirical proof is there that when your heart stops and your brain function stops, you no longer suffer? There isn't any proof. When it comes to faith, everyone has it. Everyone lives by some sort of faith. Science and faith are not mutually exclusive, nor are they in a battle. However, there is one area of science that needs to be addressed. I want to spend some time today talking about the theory of evolution and how ascribing to it as truth doesn't necessarily make sense. Now, the reason I believe that this issue specifically needs to be addressed is that some people identify this as the singular reason why they will not follow Jesus. It's an issue that many people, because of what they have come to believe, not what has been proven, mention as a problem that keeps them from making a commitment to follow Jesus. These people put their faith in a theory. Why do I say it's faith? Because science has not yet been able to answer some important questions that are required to say the theory has been proven scientifically. Here's some problems with evolution, such as a first cause. Where did the material necessary for evolution to happen originally come from? Something cannot be made from nothing. So where'd the stuff come from originally? There's the Cambrian explosion, the sudden unexplained appearance in the fossil record of complex animals that show no stages in their development. And then there's the human eye. The human eye presents a serious problem to the theory of evolution. Even the father of the theory of evolution recognized that the complexity of how the eye works cannot be properly accounted for in his theory. He says, to pose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivance for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection, seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree. If you want more, just Google the human eye and the problem with evolution. You'll see that there's no way to explain how the eye developed its ability to do those things. There was no process that you could identify that would go from being blind to an eye working like it does. So to say that evolution is not a faith-based belief is wrong. If you hold this theory as truth, you are actually putting your faith in something quite extreme. But I'm not trying to make a mainly scientific case against evolution. I think if we put our faith in anything besides God, that will surely crumble under us. It will disappoint us at some time. It will fail us or abandon us when we need it the most. The Bible is not a scientific document. It is about spiritual things. The Bible was not written to be used to fight atheists or evolutionists or agnostics. Look what it says in Ephesians 6:12. For we are not fighting against flesh and blood enemies, but against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world, against mighty powers in the dark world, and against evil spirits in the heavenly places. This battle is not against people, but attitudes about heart conditions, and the battle is fought in our hearts and minds and our spirits. The Bible, above all else, speaks of theology and philosophy, of God and attitudes, not flesh and bone. So we're going to end with a philosophical problem with the theory of evolution. One of the biggest issues for those who support evolution as fact is this. The foundational principle of evolution is that every variation and every detail that exists in the human and animal kingdom is for the sole purpose of helping us survive. Everything that's been developed over time, according to evolutionists, is so that we would survive. A fish has developed fins to help it swim better. It has developed gills to help it breathe underwater. If any species was unable to adapt to survive, they were eliminated. They died off. If a particular characteristic was needed to help the species survive, it evolved. If a characteristic was unnecessary survival, it would be eliminated. That's how evolution works. It's called survival of the fittest, or natural selection. Even emotional responses are seen as part of the evolutionary process. We have fear to keep us from danger. We have love to make sure we procreate. See, even emotional responses are seen as part of the evolutionary process. Here's the problem that evolutionists cannot seem to answer. If all that we are, everything in us, is because of the evolutionary process, and its only purpose is to help us survive, why did humans develop the cognitive ability to reason and create all the scientific knowledge that we have? What evolutionary purpose is served by humanity's need for and ability to answer questions like, why is water wet? Why is the sky blue? And why does something always fall back to earth when you throw it in the air? Let me ask it a little more specifically. What survival purpose is fulfilled by the human mind proposing that evolution is how mankind came into being? Now, this is philosophy. This might bend your brain a little bit, but stick with me. Asking questions like, where did we come from? How did life begin? Does not fulfill any evolutionary purpose. If everything we are is to have some sort of natural cause, which is what evolution says, then why did mankind develop the ability and need to discover any scientific facts? There does not appear to be any reason for humans to develop a mind that asks those kinds of questions. It does not help us survive. The very fact our minds are made so we can ask or seek knowledge like we do goes against the theory of evolution. Now, if you're a hardcore skeptic, Maybe you can hold on to the idea that somehow mankind's ability and desire to know more might possibly have had some natural cause or reason. But answer this one last problem for me. For what purpose has humanity's belief in God survived the evolutionary process? A belief in God is not necessary for us to survive. Faith in Jesus Christ is actually counterproductive to our survival. This is what Dinesh D'Souza in his book, What's So Great About Christianity, says. He says this about religion in the context of evolution. Religion seems useless from an evolutionary point of view. It costs time and money, and it induces its members to make sacrifices that undermine their well-being for the benefit of others. There is no evolutionary reason for mankind to look to God. There is no evolutionary purpose for us to worship God. So why is it there? Why is it still there? Why does it remain? Why was it not removed? What if there's a better explanation as to why we look to God? What if we're not a product of natural selection, but intelligent design? Ecclesiastes 3:11 says, "Yet God has made everything beautiful for its own time. He has planted eternity in the human heart. But even so, people cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end." God made you. He made you beautiful. And he made you with a desire to know him. That's a far better explanation than natural selection. That's a far better explanation than evolution. Amen? Let's stand together this morning.